I like the book. The book very much. It's sexier than I thought it was going to be, and yet not blatant. There was always this overlying sexuality that permeated the book, but it wasn't as though you had everything drawn out in front of you.
I'm getting too old for blatant sex, I guess.
Why don't you, for the benefit of our listeners, just briefly give us a synopsis of The World is Made of Glass.
The World is Made of Glass began as a play. After The Clowns of God, I didn't want to write another novel. I wanted to divert myself a little and at the same time avoid the postpartum depression which comes after a big book. I had done a lot of work on Jung for a number of years, simply because I was interested in his explorations into Gnostic thinking, alchemical thinking, intuitive knowledge, the effect of the past on our present lives. I had come across this story in his Memories, Dreams and Reflections, The Unknown Woman Who Came to Him to Confess Murder. I wrote the play and showed the first draft of it to my publisher, who said, "You realize that you're sitting on the Comstock Lode. You've done all this research. You've got a ready-made story. Why don't you write a novel and really flesh out what you can't do in the play, the background of this woman?" You see, I knew all about Jung, and I couldn't depart from the portrait of Jung because there's so much public work. His biography is well known. The women in his life are well known. The incidents of his life. And I had to go with that man. I could in no wise change him. He'd given us all the insights one needed for a novel. And furthermore, since he has living family, I had to be very faithful in the portrait. The woman was completely different. He had said that she was a doctor, that she was in her middle years, that she was well-educated, that she was a magnificent horsewoman, that her wolfhound had died, and that she had, in fact, murdered her best friend in order to marry the husband. And all the other things that are in the book had to be invented. I had an arbitrary choice as to where I would put her in his life. And dramatically, I could justify it. So I chose 1913, which was the last year of the Belle Epoque, the year that Jung was having his own massive breakdown, his break with Freud, the beginning of his lifetime association with Toni Wolff as a mistress and a former pupil, and his wife was having their fifth child. He had was no longer clinical director of the Bergholdsley, the big psychiatric institute in Zurich. He was no longer lecturing at the university because he couldn't focus his attention on a book or on professional work, and he was trying to support himself by private practice. So this was a critical time. Now, dramatically, it made a lot of sense. You had a 31-year-old wife. You had a 25-year-old mistress. And the next age of woman was woman in her middle years, the last flowering before winter. And a woman who clearly had left a vast impression on his life, because although his narrative in his autobiography is very cryptic, there are small revelations in it. He said she was a woman of good education. And what language did she speak? His language was Fitzerdeutsch. He spoke German, he spoke Italian, he spoke French, spoke English. What language did they converse in? He doesn't say. He said she said she was a doctor. Now, six questions, because he was a doctor, could have revealed whether or no she was a phony or whether she was truly a doctor. He says she was a magnificent horsewoman. Now, remember, she's never told him his name and wouldn't stay longer than one visit. You don't talk that way about a woman with whom you have only a passing acquaintance. If she rides to hounds, yes. She breeds horses, yes. But magnificent horsewoman and beautiful wolfhound, well, clues to some closer relationship, which I had to invent. And that's the genesis of the book.
Mm. Fascinating, the interweaving of the historical with the imaginary.
That grew, I think, out of a choice as to how I would write the book. That was the hardest part. To write the book, I finally settled on two first-person narrations. Jung, I, who am near to madness, am committing this to a journal. The woman, I, who am at the crossroads of my life, who am being forced to come to terms with the strange split person that I am, who may commit murder again, am committing this to a private revelation. Now, what I didn't know, that worked beautifully until they came together. I could see it working, you know, it's a simple filmic trick where you cut from A and meanwhile back at the ranch and meanwhile out in the country, and that worked fine. What I didn't know was how it would work during the confrontation of the actual analysis. And it wasn't until I began to write that and found that the same technique could work and that you could see the analysis from Jung's point of view and her point of view by carrying on the same cutaway process, that I truly had confidence in the book. And once I was through that, one was home free. It worked.
Another question about the book before I ask you a couple of questions about yourself. What were your conclusions about the efficacy of psychiatry? Does it work?
My conclusion is...
My feeling, just parenthetically, just to enhance the question a little bit, my feeling is sometimes psychiatry in itself, there is an underlying madness that makes one question how well it can perform a service.
Well, Jung himself was constantly aware of the fact that madness is a communicable disease, both socially and from individual to individual. The same transference that makes the patient sometimes fall in love with the therapist can affect the therapist as well. It can become a folie à deux. As a matter of fact, there's a little epigraph to the book from a modern psychiatrist who points out that Jung was constantly aware of the infectious nature of madness, especially in healing situations, in situations between therapist and patient. My other conclusion, which I believe is a very important one, is that no human being can endure sane for a lifetime without absolution, without forgiveness. Freud was a Jew. Jung was a Lutheran, German Swiss. But Freud provided for absolution. In fact, although he was an atheist, what basically he said was, once we find the root of this problem, once we find the root of this aberration, you will see that it lay in causes beyond your control, and it has changed your whole life. Now that you've come to terms with it, this is in itself an absolution. You were not necessarily the murderer, as it were. The murderer in symbol who has haunted you all your life grew out of the little boy who was threatened by this, that, or the other. Now that in itself is a kind of absolution, provided that you are not a believer in any kind of God outside it. Now, Jung was a God-haunted man. He'd abandoned his father's Lutheran faith because, according to his version of his life, his father would never debate anything with him. He said, that's the dogma, that's the belief, there are three persons in one God, blah, blah, blah. And that's what you believe, that's what the faith is, that's tradition. And Jung attempted all his life to abandon this faith, but found himself drawn back to it. I have here in New York, although we're not permitted to play it, the last interview which John Freeman, the Honourable John Freeman, did for the BBC with Jung when he was an old man in his 80s. And Jung had always hedged the question, are you a believer? The quotation in the book from the inscription over his door, called or uncalled, a God will be present, is there. I've seen it over his door. That was written over the shrine in Greek, over the shrine of the Oracle of Delphi. But in this last interview, John Freeman surprised the old man and said, Dr. Jung, do you now believe in God? And it's a rather strange moment. The old man's face sort of lights up and he realizes as he's been surprised. He's got an elfin grin and he turns and says, I don't believe in him, I know him.
We're almost out of time, Mike. I know you have another appointment, but I have to ask you a couple of more questions. You yourself are a monk, a Christian brother, is that correct?
That's right.
What was this experience like, briefly?
This experience was, and I'm giving it to you now in retrospect, while I went through it, it was both traumatic and educative. In retrospect, it has enabled me to understand very much the modern phenomenon of the conditioned man. The way I and my brethren in religion were conditioned during the novitiate year is exactly the same method which is used by groups as diverse as the Moonies and the terrorists. Controlled by exclusion of all outside influences. You will only read what is given to you. Peer pressure, constant measuring yourself against your peers, daily confession of your faults, humiliations to reduce your self-esteem and your reliance on yourself, fatigue, the day that began at 5:30 and ended at 10, and with constant activity from prayer, study, manual labor, sport, constantly over and over again with the minatory voice of the novice master, no, 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 not that way, this way, think only of God, you are the chosen of God, a notion of election, of being special and therefore not subject to outside judgments, a separation from family, a separation from body politic. I was in the monastery during the at the outset of the Spanish War, and as you know, the Spanish War, according to that particular side, the Irish side, was, you know, the Christians were being persecuted by the hateful communists, and Franco was the savior of modern Europe, and there was a concordat with Hitler that good Pope Pius XII was, and that was the view of the world. So I'm very familiar with the background of modern conditioning. It's the same thing as you do with a terrorist. You give him peer pressure, you give him fatigue, you give him total obedience, you exclude all argument, and so on and so on.
You obviously disapprove of this life. Do you harbor ill will or resentment after all of these years of that experience?
No, on the contrary. Strangely enough, the only person, and it's not ill will, it's a pity probably with anger underneath it, towards the one man in all that experience who was the novice master, who was a very stupid, pig-headed, somewhat bullying man, rather like a sergeant major. Who, in the name of God, damaged a lot of people.
Part of the human condition?
Part of the human condition.
Let me ask you a couple of questions about how you work. When you wrote The World is Made of Glass, I think obviously you approached that somewhat differently because the research had gone into a play.
Yeah.
Do you sit down and do you regiment yourself in terms of writing? Do you work on multiple drafts? How does it function with you?
It functions with me. I go into the office every morning at 8:30 in the house. And I stay there until midday, 12:30. I have a siesta, and I go back at 3:30. And I work till 5:30. I've discovered that this is the only way that I can avoid the explosive depressions that come to anybody in this creative game. I learned it from Somerset Maugham, who said, write something every day, even if it's only letters. Study something every day, even if it's not related to what you're doing. This means that you don't drink while you're working. You don't flee what you're doing. Now, after this trip, where I'm going around the world for 3 months, it's going to be one hell of a job to face a ream of blank paper to do whatever, because I'm out of practice. I'm like a tennis player that's lost his stroke, and I'm frightened I may never get it back.
I'm not sure. Maybe it's like riding a bicycle. You've had, what, 17 books under your belt? Does writing come easier as the books are published?
No, it gets harder. Because the thing you're haunted by deja vu. You're haunted by the fact, I've done that, I've said that. That's not a new point of view. You haven't explored that far enough. That's why this book is so different. I had to leap out. You see, my codex, and I can only judge it looking back on it, tends to fall into, the very first books I wrote were adventure books. Then I got embroiled in the religious dilemmas, written from the point of view of a Roman Catholic with all my background, which was Devil's Advocate, Shoes of the Fisherman, Clowns of God. Then I got caught up in the political situation with Israel, the ambassador in Vietnam, then in finance and the law with Harlequin and Daughter of Silence. All of them, it's a kind of, with due respect to the master and due humility, it's a kind of Balzacian view of taking man in his various frames. This is the first novel I've written about a woman.
The American, late American writer John Gardner said that he found it easier to write as the years went by because he learned his craft. But apparently you are not bogged down by some of the mechanical elements of structure and sort of thing. This comes easier for you.
No, that you're not. You are more concerned with matter than with manner. You are less able to lean on the facile crutches like description of places and circumstances. You know, that's as a young man, as a young writer, and I think you'll find this is true of any novelist, what makes him first attracted to his readers is the sense of youthful surprise with which he addresses any new situation. You know, the first view of Rome will produce three coins in the fountain, if you like. He'll say, we'll write a beautiful romantic novel about Rome because it's his Rome the first time. Now, I going back to Rome, no way I can recapture that first fine, careless rapture. I will see it as something completely different. The novel will begin somewhere far away from this facile and attractive background. And for me to get the attention of the reader and to hold it with, if you like, a darker and deeper theme requires a great deal more skill than rapture.
One last question, Morris West. What's it like for you returning to Australia?
I'm exploring Tom Wolfe's dictum that you can't go home again. You can go home again, but you have to be prepared to be a little like Gulliver. And not Gulliver in among the Lilliputians, but Gulliver in Brobdignag, because everybody's bigger. The little girls that you dandled on your knee are that high, and they've got little girls at heel, and the little boys are big men who look you straight in the eye and say, we don't believe in that, we don't do that like that anymore. And your old friends are a little older, but the country's still great, and there's still an excitement about it. And that's nice to connect.
Thank you very much.
A pleasure.